Did you see that poem about the, here, this one. We weren't going to do it, but since you brought it up, let me just find it quickly. Page 555, Andrew Lang. People know who he is? He was a collector, and you know, he is, say.
A little bit. No, I don't know enough about him, but I know. Don't make me introduce this.
Okay, collector, a collector of fairy tales, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Still read. Disney still makes movies out of them. So, The Last Chance. Within the streams, Pausanias saith that down Cocytus Valley flow, girdling the gray domain of Dayeth. I guess he would have pronounced it Seth. We say saith, but he would have said Seth. So within the streams, Pausanias, anyone know who he was? A Greek travel writer who also talked, an ancient Greek travel writer, who also described the landscape of the afterlife of Hades, where the rivers, do people know what the rivers of death are? Styx. Yeah. All right, so Cocytus is one of them. That's the one he's describing here. Lethe is the one you want because Lethe makes you forget everything. It's the river of peace. So within the streams, Pausanias saith that down Cocytus Valley flow, girdling the gray domain of death, the spectral fishes come and go. The ghosts of trout flit to and fro. Persephone, fulfill my wish and grant that in the shades below my ghost may land the ghosts of fish. So it's funny. You can laugh. It's funny. He hopes that when he dies, his ghostly spirit with its ghostly fishing tackle can land the ghosts of fish. So that would be good.
That doesn't sound like it was the right, like it was what the fish wanted for when they died.
That's right. It's like, okay, here we are. We're ghosts of fish, and now we get to swim around, right? But no, we get fished here too.
I've seen people talk about how dog heaven must be squirrel hell.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, good.
Where did I think? Where is that coming from?
Yeah.
So I have a couple of handouts, which I don't know whether we're going to try to get to these for various reasons. So again, two sheets coming around. So just to remind you that on Monday we're meeting in Olin Sang 201. And Jeff Nunakawa will be here and talking about Wilde and Oscar Wilde. And Wilde is, in one way, an interesting person to be focusing on right now. So, but I do want to look. Let's try reasonably quickly to look at the Kipling poem called Danny Deever.
I may be sending us backwards a little bit, but the other day when I wasn't here in class, there was a poem that I wanted to look at because I wasn't sure where it fit in our readings.
Okay.
It's the John Hamilton Simmons poem, The
Caravan. Yeah, what page? It's that's an odd one. What page?
522.
It's about human perception and it's weirdness. Did you just want to go over it, or was there a particular thing?
There was a particular reason that I wanted to bring it up, because the camera obscura is actually the name of one of my favorite video game weapons.
Oh, okay.
There's a series called Fatal Frame where you fight with a camera called the camera obscura, and you use it to fight ghosts, or shades, as they call them, and by taking pictures, you capture them in the camera.
Okay, interesting. So do people know what a camera obscura is? So this is prior, I mean, yeah, that it's something that goes back to the Renaissance. And basically what it is it's a very dark box with a pinhole in it. And if you, what that will do is through the pinhole will come a projection onto the back of this box. And what some artists used to do back then was they would trace this projection that was being projected onto the back of the box, you know, onto a canvas or a sheet of paper or something, and they would trace it. It comes upside down. I don't know if you ever did pinhole cameras when you were like in middle school. No, you didn't. Okay, well, it's like a pinhole camera. So it's something you can do. If you have a pinhole, what'll happen is it's the same thing that happens in your eye, is that what's outside will come through it and will then be upside down, projected upside down, you know, mechanically. All you need is light. Upside down on the back of the box, and that's called a camera obscura, and there are debates about which artists use it. Leonardo was very interested in the camera obscura. He thought it was very, very weird the way things flipped. So you've learned that lenses do that, but you can do it just with a pinhole. You don't need a lens to do it. And so that's what Simmons is thinking about the brain or the skull as a camera obscura. Inside the skull, the wakeful brain, attuned at birth to joy and pain, dwells for a lifetime. So, yeah, that's where you live, inside your skull. Kind of creepy, but it's true. Even as one who in a close tower sees the sun cast faint-hued shadows, dim or clear upon the darkened disk. Now near, now far they flit. So in the tower, he'll see shadows. That are cast by the sun, like in a camera obscura, onto a darkened shadow, a disk-like shadow in his room. Now near, now far they flit, while he within surveys the world he may not win, which is just like us in our skulls. Whate'er he sees, he notes, for naught escapes the net of living thought. And what he notes, he tells again to last and build the brains of men. So whatever gets into your skull, you can then talk about, and other people can think about it. Shades are we, and of shades we weave a trifling, pleasant make-believe, then pass into the shadowy night where formless shades blindfold the light. So it's all camera obscura. A little bit like the ghosts of fish. That is, we're already ghosts within our skulls. And then we talk to other people about our experience, and we weave our shades into their shades. And then when we die, we become shades. This is what human experience is the experience of shadows. And there's nothing but shadows. So I don't know how helpful that is to thinking about the video game, but maybe.
Interesting to think about it in a similar way. And they do touch upon a lot of stuff like photography. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's what photography comes from, because then what you do is, instead of having someone do it by hand, you have the first cameras were pinhole cameras too. And instead of someone doing it by hand, you just have a light-sensitive medium which captures the light that's projected onto it.
In the Victorian era, I know that they were just starting to do autopsies in Scotland in the early 19th century and all of that.
Uh-huh.
And since he's talking about living inside the skull, where were they in terms of knowledge about the body? Like, did they believe that the soul was in the brain, the heart, the liver?
Oh, no, they knew the brain. They knew about brains.
And what about, like, feelings? Like, what did...
The neurology by now was really advanced. That is, there were questions about how impulses travel down nerve cells, and how perception and how action, how the nerves interacted with perception and action. But this was something known, probably, they were starting to get it right by the end of the 18th century, and definitely by this time. Neurology was a really big thing by the end of the 19th century, and there were lots of really interesting debates and studies about it. The greatest American psychologist by far is William James, and his wonderful book, which is still wonderful, called Principles of Psychology, which came out, I think, in 1890. You can learn a lot about the experiments that were being done at the time, and how modern they were. So I know less about about neurology in the early 19th century, but Frankenstein is, you know, what Galvani had proved. So you know what galvanism is, or if you've been galvanized by something. So that's is that a verb that's not entirely unfamiliar? Galvani was basically the inventor of the battery. He realized that there were, if you put a couple of metals together, piled one on top of another. So how do you say battery in Spanish? Do you know?
No, I've never had to say that.
You've never had to like buy a battery?
No. When I was living in Spain, I never had
Your
an
iPhone
alarm clock that I need to put batteries in.
Or what about your iPhone battery getting?
No, it was fine. I didn't have to repair my phone.
Well, why my Latin? I'm pretty sure the ancient Romans didn't know what a battery would be, but my Latin professor just said batteria.
Okay.
Yeah, probably like a cognate.
Okay, in French it's pile, P-I-L-E-S.
Okay.
And that's because what Luigi Galvani did was he would put a piece of metal on another piece of metal and with some acid between them, and their interaction could cause an electric current. And it was discovered at the end of the 18th century that that you could get dead frogs to flip by putting currents through their, basically through their nerves. So this was the beginning of the discovery of the relation of impulses down the nerves as being electrical. And Mary Shelley was fascinated by this and then wrote a novel based on the idea that electricity could somehow cause what looked like life. And that novel, it's kind of scary. It's called Frankenstein. And people were studying galvanism and its relationship to nerve impulses and to the movement of muscles. And they were thinking maybe this was a secret of life, which, you know, it's part of it. But that goes, Frankenstein is 1817, she started writing it, and that goes, 1816, and that goes all the way back to then. But by the late 19th century, they were really pretty modern about it.
I think these conversations are fascinating, like the conversation of what we knew versus what we don't know, because it always brings up what we know now versus what we might not know.
Yeah.
And I think it's, like, one thing, like, that there were advanced studies of neurology to the point that people were like, you know, shocking frogs to make them move. Like, they knew that how nerves worked, and they knew that the brain was the locus of, like, thought and stuff. And they, like, this is also all during a time when they thought tuberculosis was an inherited artist disease.
Right.
And
yeah.
They thought that, like, all poets were going to die of tuberculosis.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I just think that's fascinating, like, the things that look to us.
Right.
Later on. They knew about nerves, but they didn't know about, like, airborne infection.
Yeah. And you know what Listerine is, right? The mouthwash?
Wasn't it like a floor cleaner?
No, no. So
I thought I heard something like
Lister,
that.
Lister was a surgeon who I think specialized in gynecology. But he basically said that gynecologists really, really, really had to wash their hands and be, basically they needed antiseptics, and Listerine was an antiseptic. And all these other OBGYN people said, no, that's ridiculous. And so he did it, and his patients survived. Maternal mortality went down. shockingly and tremendously when Lister was involved. But no one believed him. And so it took like another 20 or 30 years before people thought, huh, maybe it would not be a good idea to keep doing what we're doing, which is deliver one baby and then just go to the next room and deliver another baby without washing up before or after any of them.
In smaller towns, the doctors were also going and dealing with dead people.
Yeah.
And then going to the delivery, and so they were getting the diseases from the dead people, and they weren't washing.
Yeah, and somehow the delivery, if they did a delivery, it didn't bring the dead person back to life, which that would have been good. First do a delivery.
You should write that novel.
Yeah, okay. I think not. All right, so let's take a look at the poem Danny Deaver, page 539, another Kipling. It's partly we're doing it because it is the first poem of its kind, partly because it is important to Wilde's Ballad of Reading Gaol, which some of which you will have read. Ricks doesn't give you the whole thing, but do you know why Wilde wrote a poem called The Ballad of Reading Gaol? G-A-O-L is pronounced jail.
He was in the Reading Jail?
He was in the Reading Jail.
Yeah.
And why was he in the Reading Jail?
Because he's a homosexual.
And because...
And he got found out because he went to the red light district.
Well, he was involved with... a guy named Lord Alfred Douglas, Wilde was.
Yeah. Nicknamed Posey.
Yes, sorry, yes. And Douglas's, Lord Alfred Douglas's famous line is, "The love that dare not speak its name." So that is that a familiar phrase to people, "The love that dare not speak its name," which was what Douglas described as his relationship, his feeling for Wilde. Later, Lord Alfred Douglas became a total jerk, but he and Wilde were deeply involved. Wilde was really, really deeply in love with him. And Douglas's father got wind of this and was not at all happy, and dropped a note off at Wilde's house saying to Oscar Wilde, posing as a somdomite, which lots of people wonder.
Famous typo.
Yeah. At any rate, Wilde made the mistake of suing him for libel. Because he was not out, and I mean, he was not particularly discreet, but he was not out. So he sued Douglas for libel, and Douglas's father, and that meant that it was a court case. In fact, two court cases, and Wilde lost because it was proved that in fact he was gay, red light district and all. And then. Being gay at the time was a capital offense. It was a capital offense all the way, I think, until the 1960s. But no one ever got executed for it. I think there are a few people who it's debated whether they were executed for sodomy or not. But I believe that there is no clear-cut case where anyone was ever executed for it. But they were still, you know, in prison, treated like shit, and Wilde was sent to Reading Jail for 4 years. So he went from being at the very top of the world, at the top of the literary world, you know, kind of like a good guy Tucker Carlson, to being put in Reading Jail. And he was shocked by what he found there. And so he's a much greater playwright than poet. He's not a great poet, but The Ballad of Reading Gaol is a really good poem. And one of the things it describes is an execution. At any rate, one of the earlier but almost contemporary poems, so this is 6 years before Wilde went to Reading Jail is this poem by Kipling. So let's try to do it quickly because there's other stuff to do. But there are basically three speakers in the poem. Files on Parade, Color Sergeant, and the narrator. And you may wonder, what's Files on Parade? Who's Files on Parade? Files on Parade are basically the enlisted men. So a kind of personification, as though it's a single person, is what Kipling is doing, but it's the privates, those who have who are not officers, even non-commissioned officers. The color sergeant is a non-commissioned officer. So the situation is, what are the bugles blowing for? Said Files on Parade. To turn you out, to turn you out, the color sergeant said. That is, get up. That's why the bugles are blowing. What makes you look so white, said Files on Parade. I'm dreading what I've got to watch, the color sergeant said. Again, Kipling probably would have pronounced it said. That is, it's a perfect rhyme. We say said. I think in Ireland people still say said. No one in Canada? It's all said in Canada. Yeah, okay. So notice that Files on Parade and the color sergeant, they're both going to be confronted by what they're going to see. So I'm dreading what I've got to watch, the color sergeant said. For they're hanging Danny Deaver, you can hear the dead march play, the regiment in Olive Square. They're hanging him today. They've taken his buttons off and cut his stripes away, and they're hanging Danny Deaver in the morning. So it's kind of like a ballad or a song, but that's what's happening. That's going to be the refrain. And what's happening is Danny Deaver is going to be hanged. And everyone is freaked out by that. What makes the rear rank breathe so hard? Said Files on Parade. It's bitter cold, it's bitter cold, the color sergeant said. So Files on Parade is saying, why is the rear rank of us breathing so hard? Because it's cold, it's early in the morning. What makes the front rank man fall down? Said Files on Parade. A touch of sun, the color sergeant said. But that's not what's making them fall down. That's not what's making them breathe hard. It's their anxiety about this hanging they're about to see. They are hanging Danny Deaver. They are marching of him round. They have altered Danny Deaver by his coffin on the ground. And he'll swing an arf a minute for a sneaking shooting hound. Oh, they're hanging Danny Deaver in the morning. So then one of the soldiers says, is caught was right and caught to mine, said Files on Parade. That is, where he slept was at a right angle to my cot. He's sleeping out on far tonight, the color sergeant said. I drank his beer a score of times, said Files on Parade. He's drinking bitter beer alone, the color sergeant said. They are hanging Danny Deaver. You must mark him to his place, for he shot a comrade sleeping. You must look him in the face. 900 of his county and the regiment's disgrace while they're hanging Danny Deaver in the morning. So he's the disgrace of his own county, of the 900 people in his county, a disgrace to the regiment. What's that so black again the sun? Said Files on Parade. It's Danny fighting hard for life, the color sergeant said. So what's happening? He's writhing. Yeah. He's hanging and he's jerking around as he dies. What's that whimpers overhead? Said Files on Parade. It's Danny's soul that's passing now. the color sergeant said. For they're done with Danny Deaver. You can hear the quick step play. The regiment's in column, and they're marching us away. Ho, the young recruits are shaken, and they'll want their beer today after hanging Danny Deaver in the morning. So this is the poem that made Kipling famous. And it's one of lots of poems of his that are about military life. He did lead a military life later, although not nearly with the kind of experience that his speakers have. And his son was killed in World War I. All of this is later, is to come later. But he is really interested in representing a class that has not been represented in poetry. Lower class, the kind of working class, people who then become privates in the military and who are having this experience of violence and tyranny and pressure to a sort of patriotism, but are also seeing a truth that most of the people they're defending don't see. So this is something that is so, we're so used to. You know, if you think of something like Full Metal Jacket or, you know, any movies where an officer and a gentleman, whatever, any movies about military experience, and especially about military training, making that a subject for artistic representation, it's Kipling who did it. And his poems were so successful that they became just part of English culture for a really, really long time. So last class we talked about Gunga Din and the Ballad of East and West, which are also those kinds of poems. So I think the Ballad of East and West is the best of them. But Danny Deaver is in a way more radical because of the way he takes this balladic form and then gives you these two characters, Files on Parade and the color sergeant, and then the experience that they're having, which is a real life one. Happened all the time you would be executed given submitted to military justice. But anyhow, this is when. You read the Ballad of Reading Jail, it's something similar. I think Kipling makes it possible, made it possible for Wilde in prison to be able to think and write this way. I don't know what Jeff will be talking about, but it'll be good. Okay. Let us look just one more kind of Wildean or proto-Wildean moment. There's one of the things I distributed was Bunthorne's song called The Aesthete from Gilbert and Sullivan's operetta Patience. So do people know who Gilbert and Sullivan were? Who were they?
They wrote plays that unfortunately I haven't seen any, but I know in West Wing they argue about them a lot.
Oh, do they really? I'd forgotten that.
Platoon?
That's an
awesome. SS. They wrote about
The Pinafore.
They wrote SS Pinafore. They wrote plays about boats.
Yeah.
And soldiers.
Yeah. Operettas, actually. So The Mikado is a famous one. Patience is a famous one. There's actually a Mike Leigh movie about them that came out maybe 10 or 15 years ago. And they wrote these wildly successful operettas, and I'm sure you've heard some some songs from those operettas. So Gilbert was the did the lyrics, and Sullivan did the music. Have other people heard of them?
Gilbert and
Sullivan. Yeah.
I feel like the name came up in one of my students' reading before. I'm not too sure though, because it's a class about Jewish writers in Broadway.
Uh-huh.
So maybe not the same people I'm thinking about.
Well, they could have. I mean, they were basically they're still performed all the time. And I saw a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta at Northeastern not too long ago. They're really delightful. I'm just trying to think what a famous song would be. But then I might have to sing it and that would be dreadful, so I won't.
What does operetta mean as opposed to just like musical?
It's kind of halfway between a musical and an opera, which is to say it's less dialogue than a musical will have, more singing, the songs are partly going to be dramatic. Which is to say that usually in musicals, what you have is you break into a musical number and then you pick up again when the number is over. In an operetta, the songs will often will be expressive in such a way that information or human relationship develops and changes in the course of the song. I'm just trying to think what. I don't know. I'll figure out what their most famous song would be. But there's one. There's On a Tree by a River, a little Tom Tit sang Willow, Tit Willow, Tit Willow. Ooh. You know that song?
Yeah, I know that song.
Can you sing it?
I know that one line, and I'm a horrible singer. So yeah.
And I said to him, Dickie Bird, why do you sit singing Willow, Tit Willow, Tit Willow? Is it weakness of intellect, birdie, I cried, or a rather tough worm in your little inside? With a shake of his poor little head, he replied, a willow, tit willow, tit willow. So it's about love. It's about how love makes you melancholy. But the operettas are hilarious. They all end happily. They're all funny. The songs are great. The plots are really great. Topsy Turvy is the name of the Mike Leigh movie. Do people know who Mike Leigh is? He had a recent movie. He's a really wonderful English director who did lots of low budget movies about English working class life. And did a movie also about John Ruskin a few years ago. No, I mean, sorry, about Turner, where John Ruskin is a character a few years ago. Okay, so Summer, Mike Leigh, Gilbert and Sullivan, all sorts of things. Topsy Turvy is really fun. All right, so here is a kind of parody of Wilde about the aesthete. So if you're anxious for to shine in this high aesthetic line, as a man of culture rare, you must get up all the germs of the transcendental terms and plant them everywhere. So germs, you know, means seeds, right? So you must get up all the germs of the transcendental terms and plant them everywhere. You must lie upon the daisies and discourse in novel phrases of your complicated state of mind. The meaning doesn't matter if it's only idle chatter of a transcendental kind. And everyone will say as you walk your mystic way, if this young man expresses himself in terms too deep for me, why, what a very singularly deep young man this deep young man must be. So basically, you want to be an aesthete drama queen. Be eloquent in praise of the very dull old days which have long since passed away, and convince him, if you can, that the reign of good Queen Anne was culture's palmiest day. Of course, you will poo-poo whatever's fresh and new and declare it's crude and mean, for art stopped short in the cultivated court of the Empress Josephine. And everyone will say as you walk your mystic way, if that's not good enough for him, which is good enough for me, why, what a very cultivated kind of youth this kind of youth must be. Then a sentimental passion of a vegetable fashion must excite your languid spleen, an attachment a la Plato for a bashful young potato or a not too French bean. Though the Philistines may jostle, you will rank as an apostle in the high aesthetic band if you walk down Piccadilly with a poppy or a lily in your medieval hand. So that's for you. In your medieval hand. And everyone will say as you walk your flowery way, if he's content with a vegetable love, which would certainly not suit me, why, what a most particularly pure young man this pure young man must be. So it's a parody of high aestheticism. Does the phrase vegetable love ring a bell for anyone? So there's an Andrew Marvell poem called To His Coy Mistress, which begins with the famous lines, had we but world enough and time, this coyness, dear, would be no crime. So that's a 17th century poem. It's a seize the day poem, carpe diem. Do you know the term? So it's seize the day, carpe diem. If we were going to live forever, if we had world enough and time, then your coyness would be a crime, would be fine. There'd be no rush. He says, if we had enough time, a famous line, strange, famous partly because it now feels a little bit grotesque, though it didn't at the time, was that if we had world enough in time, then my vegetable love would grow larger than empires and more slow. So the idea is there'd be no rush, and eroticism could take the form, could go as slowly as plants grow. We can't slow down. The poem ends with it saying we can't slow down. If we can't slow time down, we should make him run. That is, speed everything up. Anyhow, Gilbert is echoing that phrase, vegetable love. But you know, it's a pretty funny, pretty winning parody of a certain kind of aestheticism. A certain kind of everything is has aesthetic meaning for me. And, you know, hoi polloi, they don't get it, but look at that singularly deep young man or that singularly pure young man. So that's a parody of Wilde. And a thing to say about Wilde is, so we talked about Arnold. We haven't talked about Walter Pater, but we're going to in a minute. We talked briefly about Matthew Arnold. Remember that he is who in Amour de Voyage? Do you remember who is writing to whom?
Claude is writing to someone.
Yes.
What's
his name?
Eustace.
Yes. Arnold, yeah. Yeah. So Eustace is Matthew Arnold, and Claude is Clough. So Matthew Arnold was wrote a book. He wrote a big book called Culture and Anarchy. Guess which side he was on?
Anarchy?
No.
Culture. Absolutely culture.
Yes. Culture, culture, culture all the time. And he wrote a famous work called The Function of Criticism in the Present Day. And basically he is the god of a kind of cultural conservatives. He was not himself a conservative politically, but he's the god of cultural conservatives. The only thing standing against anarchy is culture. I guess we should look at his stupid fucking poem, Dover Beach. Do you want to look at it? Do you know it? Is that where you're...
I know it, I also think it's kind of a stupid poem.
Yeah, so page...
That's actually the very first English poem I ever read in my life.
Really? And do you like it?
No.
And here you are, so yeah,
it was
poetry.
I should thank my high school teacher who, alongside that poem, there was also Shakespeare's Sonnet 18 and Coleridge's Kubla Khan. So
those are good.
Yeah.
What I felt about Dover Beach being taught it was that the teacher had this like righteous sense that Dover Beach is the home to huge high schoolers, and that like I didn't get it, but I was like, I think I'm right. I think this is not an enjoyable poem.
No, it's not an enjoyable poem. But it was, I think, in education schools and curricula in the first half of the 20th century and more in the U.S. and probably in Britain, this was regarded as the perfect poem. Mm-hmm. And it was partly regarded as a perfect poem because it is the poem talking about just how terrible things are, the only stay against them is culture, and reading poems like Dover Beach. So we'll just do it. We won't talk about it, but we'll just do it so you have it in your minds. The sea is calm tonight. The tide is full. The moon lies fair upon the straits. On the French coast, the light gleams and is gone. The cliffs of England stand glimmering and vast out in the tranquil bay. Come to the window, sweet is the night air. So the window looks out over the English Channel towards France, and it's nighttime, the sea is calm. Sweet is the night air. Only from the long line of spray where the sea meets the moon-blanched land, listen. You hear the grating roar of pebbles, which the waves draw back and fling at their return up the high strand, begin and cease, and then again begin with tremulous cadence slow, and bring the eternal note of sadness in. So sadness everywhere. Sophocles long ago heard it on the Aegean, and it brought into his mind the turbid ebb and flow of human misery. We find also in the sound a thought, hearing it by this distant northern sea. The sea of faith was once too at the full, and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled. But now I only hear its melancholy, long withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind down the vast edges drear and naked shingles of the world. So people used to have faith, now they don't. It's the 19th century. So faith no longer sustains people. Ah, love, let us be true to one another. For the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. So it's a very pessimistic poem, but which is good. His solution to this is what he calls culture, and it's not really a solution. It's just what stands against the terribleness of existence when faith no longer does is culture. And it's sort of culture as a replacement for faith, and criticism as a way of thinking clearly. So that's what he's pushing. And so he has a famous line where he says that the object of criticism is to see the world as, or to see, I'm sorry, what the task of criticism is to see the object as in itself it really is. So what you want to do is look clearly to see the object as in itself it really is. And the his great, taking the other side is Walter Pater. So if people heard of Walter Pater, not a poet, but a novelist and critic, especially an art critic. He wrote a book called The Renaissance, which is a wonderful book. He says he loved Leonardo and has wonderful things to say about Leonardo in a famous poem called The Virgin of the Rocks. Famous painting of Leonardo is called The Virgin of the Rocks. He has this great line which begins it, which is, "She is older than the rocks among which she stands." And anyhow, Pater was just a great critic. And he wrote this very famous conclusion. This is what always gets anthologized, is the conclusion to his book, The Renaissance, where he says, if you miss anything in life, you should always be alert to what's around you, aesthetically alert to what's around you. If you miss anything, longer than usual. We'll get used to it. Okay, see, we're used to it. Now I can't even hear it. If you miss anything, he says, it is on this short day of sun and frost to sleep before evening. So he basically says life is a short day, of sun and frost, and you should experience and perceive everything you can. And he has a famous line, to burn always with this hard gem-like flame. That's what your experience should be. It's like burning with a hard gem-like flame. So he... in contrast to Arnold, disagreed with Arnold, saying that you should see the object as in itself it really is. And he said, no, and this goes back to your camera obscura question, maybe. What he says is, you want to see the object as it seems. So that's like French Impressionism. That's a Paterian idea. Impressionistic painting is Paterian. It's, no, you don't want this kind of cold, clear, scientific view of the world. Scientists can do that. That's fine. But what you want to do is give a sense of how things seem to us, not the object as in itself it really is, but the object as it seems to us. And then Wilde, who loved Pater, brought this to... Wilde was just great at being outrageous. And he brought this to its outrageous conclusion, where he said, no, the function of art is to see the object as in itself it really is not. So he simply negates what Arnold says, not... what it is, not even what it seems, but what it isn't. So some of you, do people know about the picture of Dorian Gray? Do you know the story?
Yeah.
Very quickly.
Oh, so there's this extremely beautiful young man, Dorian Gray, and I think there's this really evil guy around him just giving him this idea, you know, what if one day you become old and no longer be young and beautiful, so... And then somehow you got this painting, and you realize instead of him aging, the picture of him in the painting, he is aging instead of him. So he, you know, with nothing to lose, he became also evil.
Yeah.
I kind of forgot how it ends, but yeah.
The painting's destroyed, yeah. And he suddenly becomes old.
Yeah.
But so there's, you can see there's an aesthetic issue going on there, where he is maintaining his beauty, but the painting, which should be a record of his beauty, is what's aging. And if you look in the painting, you can see what he should really be looking like. That's the idea that Wilde, that's sort of the central idea. But there's a very famous preface, a one-page preface that Wilde wrote to the picture of Dorian Gray, which are basically like 12 sentences about the nature of art. The final sentence is, all art is perfectly useless. And that for him is high praise. That is, that art is never about being useful. It's about something which is just completely orthogonal to usefulness. He's got wonderful lines. He has another one. None of you smoke. Have any of you ever smoked? He has a wonderful line about cigarettes, which is, it is the perfect type of a perfect pleasure. They are exquisite, and they never satisfy. So for Wilde, that is what a perfect, in a sense, that's what a perfect aesthetic pleasure would be. It's exquisite, and it would never satisfy you. Because then it would have a use. If it satisfied you, it would be useful. But it's just aesthetic pleasure. So that is what Wilde is pushing.
What is the talk on the going to be about?
I don't know. I think about Wilde.
No, I mean concerning Wilde's point.
Don't know. It's not a talk. It's a class.
Gotcha.
So he's listened to some of the classes. And he's a fantastically good teacher. We team taught a course once, which is great, and you'll like him. All right, so let's look. I think we have time for this. There are a couple of things that I still want us to look at today. So, but with that in mind, let's look at, what page is this? I've gone too far. Have I gone too far? Yeah, let me just look at the... That's after Oscar Wilde. Let's look at a poem called The Dark Angel by Lionel Johnson. So Lionel Johnson, there are a few poets in this group of poems that we're doing, Lionel Johnson being one of them, who belong to a group that Yeats pretty much founded called the Rhymers Club. And they would drink together, and then they also put out a couple of anthologies of their poetry, and Yeats wrote about them later. He was one of the founders. He was close friends with them, but they were basically turn of the century poets in London who were feeling with the turn of the century, that was the end of an era. They were highly aesthetic. Wilde would sometimes join them. And they were also famous for dying young. So Lionel Johnson, as you can see, died, I think, at 35. Yeah. Another one is Ernest Dowson, another really interesting one of these aesthetic poems. Another one was someone named George Moore, who I don't think Ricks has in his anthology, also known as A.E., and as I say, Yeats. And they were... if you think of, and there's actually a poem that we read for today called The Absinthe Drinker. I'm just looking for what page that's on. References are to poem number 563. Thank you. By Arthur Symons, who was involved with them. So just if people know about absinthe, it's just look at the lines. The hours are all linked in a dance of mere forgetfulness. So it's a kind of shadowy, just going back to that idea of the shades, it's living in a shadowy world, escaping the real world in this aesthetics of shadow.
What exactly is absinthe? Because I've asked several different people and I've never gotten one straight answer.
It's, you can't get a straight answer about absinthe. Anyone know?
It's an alcoholic drink that sometimes provides, hallucinations.
Hallucinations. Yeah. So it was actually illegal in the U.S. till about 30 years ago, I think. So it is a kind of licorice-like drink. Has anyone ever read Hills Like White Elephants, the Hemingway story? One of his great, great stories. He's not a great novelist, in my opinion, but he has like five or six great stories. Well, the young woman in Hills Like White Elephants at one point says, it's like everything else, it's a disappointment. It's like absinthe. You just want to drink absinthe, you want to know what it's like, and then it's meh. But it absinthe drinkers, it ruins the liver, it gets you more than alcohol in general does. It gets you completely, puts you in a kind of dreamy hallucination, not an opiated hallucination, you could say, not an energetic hallucination, the way a lot of other hallucinogens do, and it's a way of escaping the world into something that feels aesthetic, not just like the opium and the literary nature of opium is that it deadens and dulls the world. But for absinthe, it's like you go into a world of shadows, is how it's always described. But look at the poem called The Dark Angel by Lionel Johnson. So the thing to know about Johnson was that he was gay. He hated it, hated the fact that he was gay. He liked others. He became Catholic as a way to try to deal with his own impulses. And the dark angel here is essentially the what is troubling him. So we'll go through it, but he addresses the dark angel. Dark angel, with thine aching lust to rid the world of penitence, malicious angel, who still dost my soul such subtle violence. So he addresses the dark angel, and he describes it as having an aching lust to rid the world of penitence. The dark angel doesn't think that you should feel repentant about anything. Thine aching lust to rid the world of penitence. That is a characterization of Shelley, whom he loved and was troubled by. Shelley called guilt a kind of narcissism. That if you felt guilty, if you felt penitent, if you beat yourself up over things, that was a way of becoming self-obsessed and giving yourself an excuse to be self-obsessed. Shelley says, you know, fix things. If you've done something wrong, fix it. But he doesn't say just brood on how bad you are. That's no good at all. So Shelley, well, you may disagree, but that's his view.
No, I'm just thinking it was kind of a hypocritical thing for Shelley to say.
I don't think so.
Just really, especially given like a lot of his later poems, especially the more personal ones.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, sure.
But why, they don't have penitence in them. They may have despair.
That's a much longer conversation. Yeah.
Anyhow, that... Quinn.
How very Alcoholics Anonymous of him to be... That is very, like...
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, no, it's very, like, early tenets of, like, 12-step programs to be, like, your guilt is a self-obsession. Why
yes.
Why don't you go do something about it?
Yeah, yeah. Never would have thought of Shelley in those being like that, but yeah.
I more was like, who in the 12-step program was taking from Shelley?
Yes, yeah, yeah. So he goes on, and he blames the dark angel. Because of thee, no thought, no thing abides for me undesecrate. That is, because of you, everything is desecrated. Dark angel, ever on the wing, who never reachest me too late. You're always haunting me. When music sounds, then changest thou its silvery to a sultry fire. So when I hear music, you make it sultry, which means eroticize it, something like that. Then changest thou its silvery fire to a sultry fire. Nor will thine envious heart allow delight untortured by desire. So there you can feel his own anxiety about his homoerotic desires. Through thee, the gracious muses turn to furies, O mine enemy. So what would that mean? The muses turn to furies?
It seems like an obvious the beautiful inspiration turns to, like, evil shadows.
Yeah, that want to tear him apart. So it's something like I think about writing poetry, and then I'm just full of despair and self-torture. As soon as I think in those terms, they become, just opening myself up to trying to think deeply becomes self-torture. And all the things of beauty burn with flames of evil ecstasy. So there he's thinking of Pater, the hard gem-like flame. All the things of beauty burn with flames of evil ecstasy. Because of thee, the land of dreams becomes a gathering place of fears. So his fantasies are fantasies that horrify him. Until tormented slumber seems one vehemence of useless tears. When sunlight glows upon the flowers or ripples down the dancing sea, thou, with thy troop of passionate powers, beleaguerest, bewilderest me. So the sunlight just makes me feel terrible. Within the breath of autumn woods, within the winter silences, the venomous spirit stirs and broods, O master of impieties. The ardor of red flame is thine, and thine the steely soul of ice. Thou poisonest the fair design of nature with unfair device. So, again, everything beautiful becomes for me something that tortures me. So this is the kind of flip side of Wilde and of Pater, is that it's all beauty itself becomes painful. Apples of ashes, golden bright, waters of bitterness, how sweet, O banquet of a foul delight prepared by thee, dark paraclete. Do people know what the paraclete is? What that word means?
Yes, it's often used in reference to the Holy Spirit in the Christian tradition, but
yes.
It also just doesn't just mean like an advocate or something like that?
A comforter, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. So it is a word that means comforter, and that's because in the Gospel of John, Jesus says that I have to go, but God will send his comforter to comfort thee when I'm gone. And that comforter is known as the Paraclete. And it's another name for the Holy Ghost, because Jesus says, the Holy Spirit will come to comfort thee. That's where the idea of the Holy Ghost or Holy Spirit comes from.
I don't understand the idea of the Holy Spirit. That's a very long conversation.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a theological attempt to combine certain things that are probably not related to each other.
Awesome.
So, thou art the whisper in the gloom, the hinting tone, the haunting laugh. Thou art the adorner of my tomb, the minstrel of mine epitaph. I fight thee in the holy name, yet what thou dost is what God saith. So I fight against despair. The dark spirit is the spirit of despair. But it's what you do is what God says you should do, like in the book of Job, where God lets Satan do whatever he wants to Job as long as he doesn't kill him. So people know that's how the book of Job starts. All right, I will remind you. The book of Job, where God has more lines than in any other book of the Bible by far, begins with God saying, things are looking pretty good. Oh, Satan, what are you doing here? Where have you been? Satan there is not the devil, but the accuser or antagonist. Satan says, oh, I've been all over the earth, walking up and down on it, and boy, human beings are terrible. And God says, have you considered my servant Job? He's a really good guy. And Satan says, yeah, well, he's a good guy because he's rich and happy. And he has everything he wants from you. But if you were to challenge him, he would turn evil. He would break bad. And God says, let's bet. Let's see if that really happens. You can do terrible things to him as long as you don't kill him. And let's see how he responds to adversity. So Satan does terrible things to him. And Job is miserable. His wife tells him, you should curse God and die. But he refuses, but he's still miserable. And then finally he gets a chance to ask God, why is this happening to me? And God says, you don't understand anything. And that's where God has this enormously long aria of everything in the world that Job doesn't understand. But the idea in the book of Job is that Job is being tested by being miserable, even though he is a virtuous person. He's still made miserable. And the question is, will he continue to be virtuous after he's made miserable? And the answer in the book of Job is yes, but it's a very troubling work. So that's what he's thinking of. Yet what thou dost is what God saith. God gives Satan, or gives the dark spirit here, permission to do this as to test him. Tempter, hence the temptation comes from God. Tempter, should I escape thy flame, thou wilt have helped my soul from death. So if I can avoid your flame, then maybe I will avoid the death that I so fear. Which death? The second death that never dies, that cannot die when time is dead. So hell, essentially, is what he's saying. Live death wherein the lost soul cries eternally uncomforted. That's the lost soul dies, cries eternally uncomforted, and there, that's the death that never dies. Dark angel, with thine aching lust. So clearly the dark angel is himself, his own aching lust. Dark angel, with thine aching lust of two defeats, of two despairs, of those two, less dread a change to drifting dust, than thine eternity of cares. So I'd rather be nothing. Of two ways of dying, I'd rather be nothing at all, be annihilated. Do what thou wilt, thou shalt not so, dark angel, triumph over me. I won't have an eternity of cares. And then the great last lines, lonely unto the lone I go, divine to the divinity. So lonely unto the lone I go is somehow the same thing as divine to the divinity. And it's lonely unto the lone I go is actually from Plotinus. It's a line in the mystical Neoplatonist philosopher Plotinus. And that's his description of death, lonely unto the lone, unto the all, into the realm of the alone. But then you're part of it. And so that's a way of being divine. Instead of experiencing this intense desire and need that is torturing him. And so part of what's happening here, you could say what's happening in Wilde as well, is that high aestheticism and eroticism are put together. That is, that a high aesthetic, if you're shining in the high aesthetic line, to quote the Gilbert song, then what that means is to eroticize everything, or to aestheticize eroticism, to have this intense experience, which is an aesthetic, which is an experience of feeling, which is an experience of experiencing itself. And for Wilde, that's a great thing. For Johnson, not so much, because he is repressing it. He doesn't want this. Aching lust versus penitence, and having converted to Catholicism, what he wants is penitence. And those last lines are just great. Lonely unto the lone I go, divine to the divinity. But what it's a poem about is experiencing really, really strongly a certain kind of desire, which is where erotic and aesthetic desire are the same. Which, you know, there's a very long argument in the history of aesthetics about whether finding a person good-looking or desirable and finding a piece of art beautiful. Why do we use the word beautiful about people and about art? Is the word being used the same way when you say that someone is beautiful, which will ultimately be an expression of desire or frequently be an expression of desire, and you look at a work of art and you say it's beautiful, but that's not maybe the same thing as desire? Or is it? Is it displaced desire? Is it... So the relation of two places that in many, many different languages and cultures, the same word is used for something which is aesthetically pleasing and something which sparks erotic desire. What is the relationship between those two things? And that's a question for Wilde, and it's a question for Johnson, and essentially they both agree. That those things are similar. And for Wilde, it's great. For Johnson, it's terrifying. But they are on the side of making those things equivalent. Freud basically said that if you're an aesthete instead of... If you devote your life to aesthetics rather than to eros, it's a displacement. So one kind of desire gets displaced into another kind. One kind of pleasure, which is obviously erotic, gets displaced into another kind of pleasure, which feels as though it's not erotic. But again, he's saying they do have the same roots. Okay, one other thing. Let's look at the Yeats poem. called A Cradle Song. And what I did, I wanted to show you, this is on, well, yeah, we should try to do two Yeats poems, what we want. But I want to show you a revision that Yeats makes. So the version of A Cradle Song on page 566 is the first version that Yeats wrote. The Gaelic epigraph is actually from an early 19th century novel. Yeats's Gaelic was actually not good, although he tried to, he wanted to think it was. But this is from a song, basically a lullaby in an early 19th century novel, and these two lines can be translated: "What will I do without my darling when you're grown up and old?" And so that's his epigraph. And then he writes, "The angels are bending above your white bed. They weary of tending the souls of the dead. So they would rather be with a living child than with the dead." And so the angels are there. "God smiles in high heaven to see you so good. The old planets seven grow gay with his mood." So God's in a good mood, and so are the planets, because he's in a good mood. "I kiss you and kiss you with arms round my own. Ah, how shall I miss you when, dear, you have grown." So he revised that later, like 11 years later or so, into the version that I distributed. And I prefer the revised version, but it's also worth seeing how Yeats revises it and how he becomes metrically... He's the probably the most musical of the poets that we're doing after Tennyson, or after Swinburne, but he becomes metrically more daring. So the angels are stooping above your bed. So notice that he gets rid of the white. And you can hear the difference there. The angels are stooping above your bed. And it's not as rhythmical as above your white bed. But he decides it's better to get rid of that syllable. The angels are stooping instead of bending above your bed. They weary of trooping with the whimpering dead. Now he adds a syllable. So instead of the souls of the dead, again, you can hear how much more regular that is, right? The angels are bending above your white bed. They weary of tending the souls of the dead. But now that becomes the angels are stooping above your bed. They weary of trooping with the whimpering dead. God's laughing in heaven, instead of God smiles in high heaven, God's laughing in heaven to see you so good. The sailing seven are gay with his mood. Again, rhythmically different. Not the old planet seven, but the sailing seven are gay with his mood. I sigh that kiss you. So not I kiss you and kiss you, but I sigh that kiss you. For I must own, four syllables, that I shall miss you when you have grown. And you can feel that he's sighing a lot more as he says that. Just the rhythmical changes that he makes, you can feel the kind of sadness there. Yeah.
There's also something a little more perhaps sinister that I can read from this.
Uh-huh.
With some of the changes to vocabulary. I didn't even notice that first one where you said that the use of the white bed is gone.
Yeah.
Almost as if it's a way of saying, like, the purity of this person is gone, or uh-huh, almost gone, and the way that God is laughing in heaven and the sailing seven almost made me think of the seven deadly sins.
Huh.
And how God is laughing and how good you are with these sins and laughing about your hopes of getting into heaven.
Okay. Well, I think I don't read it that way, but I think what we maybe we're both responding to, is that there's a sadness, anticipatory sadness in the second version, which is officially there in the first, for I must own that I shall, I'm sorry, in the first, which is, ah, how shall I miss you when, dear, you have grown. But 11 years later means that she has grown. And it's as though the revision is itself an acknowledgement of missing her now. And so I think you're responding to the same difference in tone in the second from the first. Okay, we should stop, right? Right. So where are we meeting Monday? All right, good. See.